service for seasonal employees. HGR 51 relating to the hull of testing of nuclear weapons. First bill will be House Bill 371 relating to credited service for seasonal employees. 371 could provide credited service for seasonal employees based on hours worked rather than on days worked. The bill is introduced by Representative Boyer. Representative Boyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Mark Boyer. I represent District 20 in the House of Representatives. I want to thank you for scheduling this bill. HB 371 simply is a bill designed to make it easier for seasonal employees to, one, become vested in the state retirement system, and two, to ultimately receive the retirement benefits that I feel and others feel should accrue to them in a more timely fashion. The problem that we're trying to address here is that seasonal employees, many of whom work exceptionally long hours during the summer season, either through some of them through fire service training or fire service work or fish and wildlife or fish and game work, currently only receive credit for those hours as they relate to a day's service. For instance, if a person were on a 6-12 series of hours worked, the person would only receive credit for the actual physical day characterized, I suppose, in a 24-hour fashion, and wouldn't necessarily reflect those additional hours contributed to the system, hours that they're paying actually into the PERS system for, but would not receive the benefits of those additional overtime hours as they relate to accrual of time for retirement and the full benefits of that means. So in effect, what happens is you end up with seasonal employees who have to serve a much longer period of time, one, to receive vesting, and then two, ultimately, to retire. The bill only changes the system by suggesting that instead of having these employees vest and ultimately retire based on the days worked in the system, that would calculate that based upon the hours worked and wouldn't allow, as you see, there's a delimiting figure there, and would not allow for a seasonal employee to get credits above and beyond what would accrue normally to a full-time employee of the state of Alaska, permanent full-time employee of the state of Alaska. I think the real benefit of that is that people who put in long hours in some of the more grueling and physically demanding jobs in the state of Alaska, typically young people, can vest in the system and can look forward to a retirement system in some which is more normal, resembles a more normal retirement for other state employees and other jobs in state government. That's good for at least a number of reasons. One, it's a social policy issue. We ought to be concerned about people having adequate retirement to sustain a decent lifestyle in the state of Alaska. And two, we have to make sure that those people have access to health care, adequate health care in that long term. And I think that what we're suggesting here certainly contributes to both of those things as people reach retirement. It also has a third benefit in that it acts as an incentive for retention of these people. The kind of experience that some of these employees bring to the state is valuable to the state. People who return again and again and again to work in some of these very difficult and sometimes life-threatening jobs is important. The experience is something that we ought to put a premium on, and currently the system does not recognize that by providing for regular vesting time and regular retirement based on the hours actually worked. I can answer questions if people have them. I think there are people on the line who are willing to speak to the bill. I know that the Division of Retirement Benefits is here and also has some concerns or interest in the piece of legislation, but I'd be happy to answer questions if members have them.
Sure.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mark, the one piece of information in the packet I do not see is a fiscal note. Is there one?
Currently, the Division of Retirement Benefits, I think, will have something for the committee, but it wasn't available to us either.
Thank you.
Can you explain to me how, in this scenario that you have typed up here, mm-hmm. where the person that works 6 days a week, 12 hours a day, compared to the person that works the normal 5 years there, what's the difference that they pay in retirement? Do they pay in by the hour, or do they pay in, how would that come out?
The You pay in, I think, based on a gross amount of money, so the amount you pay in will not be affected by this bill. And the actuarial aspect, and I should even use that term because I'm never quite sure what that means, but the employee, because the amount of money is based on a gross amount of dollars and not on the hours worked, should not be affected. These people, and that's the other part of the problem, is the seasonal employees feel like they're paying into the system, and they are. They're contributing based on their amount of money, the gross. And of course, can't quite get there. And while most private unions have changed this practice to conform more with what's being presented here, in the old days, and I know because my father is one of those old employees who was an iron worker for 40 years and never quite got to vesting and never got to retirement. So a man like that or a woman in that situation is currently left with relying on Medicare for their medical retirement, and Social Security, and you know, hopefully they've accrued some additional savings somewhere. But that's not the lifestyle that we in this country are ascribing to today in most of our public and or private retirement systems. And that's an aspect of what this bill is attempting to change.
So it appears that the guy that's working this shorter period with a lot of overtime is paying, I mean, he would be paying in the same amount of money as the normal employee working a normal duty day, but yet not getting the credit for it.
That's correct.
As I look at it. Representative Baker.
Mr. Chairman, Mark, could you explain to me, let's take this one step further to the local municipalities and local governments. It seems to me that there is an unknown fiscal note for municipalities as well. Let's take school lunch ladies, for example, that work 2 hours per day. Would this legislation impact those? Because they're truly, they don't work the long day, but they work the short day, and so they may not qualify, I believe, under the current PERS system.
That's correct. They currently would not qualify. Permanent part-time employees have to work at least half of qualifying days or pay periods full-time amount. So that person would not qualify currently, as I understand it, and would only be affected by this bill in as much as, while I don't think that you could characterize them as seasonal employees, I suppose, well, I'd have to leave that to the department, but I don't think that you would characterize them as seasonal employees. They'd be permanent part-time, but certainly not part-time for qualifying under the existing.
I think that you answered where the thrust of my question was going to be, then are we being discriminatory against that person that works 180 school days and comes in every day, although she or he only works 2 hours a day? And here you may have a person on the other end of the spectrum that works 90 days but works an elongated day. And I guess I'm having difficulty seeing why we should discriminate against one person and then grant a benefit to another person.
Well, that's probably a larger issue, Mr. Chairman, and the system does discriminate against employees. We've got the TRS, which has lots of discrimination built in. In fact, it was just last year that I think we changed the law in TRS to allow for part-time teachers to receive retirement vesting and retirement payout in line with other 20-year retirements for teachers. Their pro rata share is less, obviously, but at least they could retire in a timely fashion. It was taking, you know, you'd have to work 40 years or more. But I mean, the system is an imperfect one. I'm proposing, I guess, to make it more perfect instead of less perfect, but we clearly aren't covering all the areas of imperfection in the retirement system. And I'm not sure, though, with regard to the example used, whether or not there is some provision by contract for those educational support employees, like the one that you mentioned. I'm not sure whether or not there are other contract provisions which might cover some aspect of that, so I shouldn't even speak to that one.
Mr. Chairman, I guess my point is that I'm not sure that if we're going to do a piece of legislation, then we probably should fix it for the system. You know, if you pick off a little piece at a time, you know, you still have you know, last year we fixed one particular element of the system, but you still have several elements, and this is another one today, and I don't know what the fiscal note is and all this, but it seems kind of unfair to just reach out and fix it for one segment when we're not treating all the people the same.
Well, I sort of look at it differently. I think here's a group of people that are working normal hours, and they're paying in so much money to that system, and here's a group that are working shorter number of days, but almost as many hours, or maybe as many hours, and they're paying as much money as these people are. People that are only working 2 hours a day, they're not, number one, they're not even paying into the system because they're not qualified to pay into the system. So these guys are really, this bill addresses, are being treated unfairly because they're paying the same amount of money into a retirement system as a normal employee. So the people you're talking about aren't. And that's where there's a real distinction, I believe. Other questions of the sponsor, I think what I want to do is bring up the division requirements and maybe have them elaborate a little bit. Why don't you just take the chair around there for us? Who's here from retirement? Bob?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Bob Stallnaker, Deputy Director for the Division of Retirement and Benefits. Perhaps to clarify a few of the issues that have been discussed this morning, first of all, the administration opposes this bill because, in fact, it would set up more inequity with the system than currently exists. I think to answer your concern about members paying in contributions that they're not getting recognized equally is the fact that a person who works 6 months with a lot of overtime gets a higher benefit than a person who works currently 6 months with no overtime. The system is already set up to acknowledge and to recognize overtime pay in annualizing salaries, so that the person who works 6 months with a lot of overtime gets an annualized salary much higher than somebody who works 6 months without overtime. So the contribution the person is paying for overtime is recognized when the benefit is paid. The concerns that we have are basically...
Can I back up, Bob, before
sure.
We go further? You're saying that the people are getting paid, they're getting compensated through salary. But are they not paying, if someone has an overtime, is getting overtime for 6 months, and here's a person not getting overtime, and they're working relatively the same number of hours in a year, are they not paying into the retirement system relatively the same then also?
Mr. Chairman, as an example, first of all, two people who work 6 months, one person working overtime, the other person doesn't. The person who's working overtime pays more into the system and will receive a higher benefit from the system than the person who doesn't work overtime. Because they're paying contributions, they're getting a larger salary recognized. In addition to whatever an employer and collective bargaining process prescribe for treatment of overtime. I mean, that's the other issue that we find with this, is that currently the employers of the system recognize overtime in different ways with different classes of employees. Some employees, as supervisory employees in the state of Alaska, don't get recognized overtime. They don't get paid it, regardless of how many hours you work. Most employees get recognized overtime a time and a half. So they're getting recognized for the additional hours working. Where that comes into play as far as retirement benefits goes, if somebody is working or getting paid time and a half for the overtime, and in a six-month period of time, a normal employee might have earned $20,000. But somebody worked overtime and earned $30,000 in that six-month period of time. When the benefit is calculated, it will be based on an annualized salary of $60,000, not $40,000. So they do get recognized for an additional benefit, a higher benefit than had they not worked overtime. Okay? The issue that seems to be here is one of whether or not somebody who works five parts of the year of service should be eligible for a benefit under the system, when a person who has worked a full year for 5 years is eligible for a benefit under the system. I don't see that as an inequity. And traditionally, with most retirement systems, it's not an inequity. You generally recognize the people who work this, you know, the person who works 6 months has other economic opportunities available to them for the other 6 months that a person who works a full year does not have. Generally, we find most people who work in jobs that are seasonal want to work in jobs that are seasonal for all kinds of reasons. The collective bargaining process is established for employers to work with their collective bargaining representatives to deal with overtime pay. The system recognizes overtime and pays a benefit equivalent, whether a person is a full-time or a seasonal employee. The inequity that this would set up is granting a group of employees, and secondly, the purpose of the systems are to attract and retain, as Representative Boyer pointed out. At this point in time, we've not received any concern from, first of all, the departments within the state that there's any need to enhance benefits to attract or retain. They seem to have the people they need and seem to have lists of people available. So a real question is, if the purposes of the system are to help employers attract and retain people, there doesn't seem to be that need. Of course, the other issue is the equity issue. And as we point out, I believe that currently the system is treating employees who work a full year equitably with employees who work a partial year, and employees who work a half day equitably with employees who work a full day. An employee who is a full-time, full-year employee also is subject to receiving less than a year of service if they do not work the full year, regardless of how much overtime they've worked in the time they've worked. If you have an employee who works 10 months out of the year and they're in a full-time position, they have leave without pay for the other 2 months, their service is not a full year of service. Their service would be 10 twelfths or 5/6 of a year of service, regardless of how much overtime they work. That overtime, once again, would be recognized in the benefit calculation. So I guess the two problems we have are one of equity within the system, and secondly, one of that the employers currently deal with overtime treatment and pay through the collective bargaining process, and the retirement systems, are, as we know, are not subject to collective bargaining. So I'll be happy to answer any of the questions.
Representative Blair. Well, it sounds like, I'm sorry, Representative Blair, I'd like to record and note that we were joined by Representative Grunberg about 8:45, and Representative Choquette about 8:55. And also, for those of you on teleconference, Representative Randy Phillips has been with us for the majority of this meeting. Representative Boyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. It sounds like the system has more problems, though, than I even suggested, or Representative Baker might have suggested. It sounds like there are lots of inequities, and I don't know that by saying that we recognize or that they receive benefits because of this additional money that, you know, they get paid out ultimately. If they ever reach heaven, they may get paid out in higher benefits. I mean, so if a commissioner makes a lot more money, the commissioner gets a higher payout, or deputy director gets, you know, a higher payout based on higher wages. Wages paid in and benefits coming out, that's not an increased benefit. That is the way the system works, right? I mean, that's not benefits. It's just the way the money in equals something coming out on the other end. I don't know that that's an additional benefit. Someone putting in X over here gets X less something over here. And I don't know how you can argue that that's a benefit.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Boyer, certainly the benefit formula, which is one of the elements of the benefit formula, is the salary that people earn in a 3 high-year period, is part of the benefit structure of the system.
And you alluded to, Mr. Chairman, a kind of choice of lifestyles. I mean, those are my words. You didn't say that, but suggesting that, you know, people come in, they work seasonal job, and then are off to wherever they're off to, or having other economic activities. And I don't know that we should penalize that or suggest that because those people have those opportunities that they shouldn't have fair access to a retirement system because of a lifestyle choice. The retirement system, Mr. Chairman, I think is important. I mean, it's become an important social piece of our, that kind of the backdrop to everyone's future. And in as much as the public ends up paying for that, the inadequacy of our planning for people's future, and that it's spread across the backs of everyone, our Social Security system, our health delivery system, we end up paying for those people one way or another. And in Alaska, we choose to, I think, fairly benefit lots of people in our retirements and benefits section. We have a fairly rich benefit package for employees, and that's a choice that we've made. And these people, some of them will never get that system. Some people drop out along the way, and I think that the system is structured in a way in recognition that people drop out. People drop out of the system. People don't work to vesting. A person that is in this situation might take 8, 9, 10 years, 12 years to vest. Some of those people never get there. And the system works because some people never get there. And so those dollars are in the system. They're kicking around the system, and the person never receives a benefit from that. And it's structured that way. And I don't know that we shouldn't, what the bill here proposes to do is allow more of those people to get the vesting so that they can access the dollars that they're paying into the system.
Mr. Chairman, first of all, I certainly have never considered the retirement systems as a state social system, and I don't believe that most of the employers would either. I mean, I think they look at the retirement system as a vehicle to help them in their job of trying to get good quality employees, provide a form of benefits that serves two purposes. One is to help attract and retain, to keep good employees. And secondly, provide a level, as Representative Boyer pointed out, certainly a very generous level of benefits for those employees. And long-term employees are definitely appreciated by most employers. So I would hope that we don't characterize the retirement systems as a social system like Social Security or like our state health systems and so forth, because these are employer tools and have to be paid by the employer to help that employer do a job. As far as other social economic opportunities available to all of us, the fact that an employee works 6 months, that employee has another 6 months of economic opportunity open to him. That's not a bad thing. That's in some cases by a lot of employees a very valuable benefit to them to be able to work, as an example, a school system and have the summer off to be with the family to help reinforce the family structure or to do other activities. The statement that a person has other economic opportunities available to them for working less than a year is just a fact. It's not a critique or a comment or a bad thing. It's just a fact that they do have that available.
Mr. Chairman?
Sam Greenberg.
The only letters I've seen in the file in support of this are from seasonal firefighters. Can you tell me, besides seasonal firefighters, who else would be covered by this? You're starting assuming a certain level of knowledge, which I just don't have.
Snow removal?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Representative Goober. Certainly the seasonal firefighters are of a major concern from what we understand. There's also employees with the Department of Transportation that will work during the summer months and take the winter months off.
What kind of employee? What kind of employees?
I believe those type of employees are
operators for snow removal, certainly.
He's talking about summer now.
Our highway engineer technicians is the title that they usually have. That's the majority of their seasonal. And whether they work in the wintertime, I guess, as snow removal, or in the summertime in upgrading the road systems or whatever, I don't really know. But I do know that with the Department of Transportation, that's generally the type of position they have. Other employees in the state are fish and wild game, or fish and wildlife technicians who will work during summer months. Stream guards, I think, is a common term. And they'll work two or three months a year, generally during the summer, take off, end up, most of them are generally fairly young, go back to school, things like that. But of the state, those are primarily the three departments that have the most seasonal employees.
Are any of them unionized?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Grunberg, I really couldn't answer that question.
Yes, they are. Some?
They are. How about the firefighters? Yes.
Well, I mean, they're members of their association, either ASME, or not ASME, ASEA, Tech and Fish. Some of them are, yes.
It seems to me that, Mr. Chairman, if I may, we've made certain specific allowances and encouragements to people in hazardous occupations that are physically demanding, firefighters is one of them, to encourage people because they're in some ways, they have to be very physically fit. They don't necessarily have a long professional life. And so as a result, they, as a practical matter, won't be able to qualify in many cases. And I see a firefighter in a different situation than a screen guard or somebody who operates a piece of equipment. But let's focus on the firefighters a minute. I know, and I realize the bill isn't limited to that, but those are the people who seem to have written in, at least the people I have in my file. Don't you think that maybe that firefighters who were seasonal firefighters, number one, you've got to have them to control the forest fires. Number two, the forest fires only occur in the summertime, so by definition, it's seasonal because the fires aren't the rest of the year. Number three, it's very physically demanding, it's very hazardous, and they're lucky to make it through in one piece. Don't you think that we do have some very significant policy considerations that maybe these people are especially deserving?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Bloomberg, I certainly wouldn't argue with that. I mean, and I think that the Department of Natural Resources would probably feel that way too. But I guess if what we're talking about here is to say we've got a group of employees, firefighters, who should get recognition for receiving a benefit in less time than a full-time employee would normally have, then as was done with the legislative temporary employees, they were recognized to be eligible for a benefit after five sessions. Certainly they don't have 5 years of benefit calculation, but they are recognized to receive a benefit after five sessions. Then perhaps that's the way to deal with it, rather than to go into the basic structure of the system, which is to recognize it day for day, and start recognizing overtime over and above a different way that employers and employee groups negotiate for. So I would recommend that if in fact we are looking at a group of employees that we're trying to get a benefit to earlier to enhance retention or enhance attraction, then maybe that's the way we should be looking at it.
Mr. Chairman, that's not exactly where I'm coming from. There are two different questions. Number one is whether to get them the benefit earlier, and that is the question of when you vest. That's not the issue that the bill deals with. The issue that the bill deals with, at least that's not the main issue that the bill deals with. The bill deals with an issue, as I understand it, that they would get additional credit for additional number of years, looking at not the number of years that were worked, but the equivalent number of years that were worked, because the years that were worked are compressed into a few months. And it's basically, we have somebody who's sitting at a desk for 20, 25, 30 years, and an 8-hour-a-day job spread out over the 365 days of the year minus time off. And on the other hand, we have somebody that's out in the field who's working the same number of hours, but because of the physical fact that the fires don't occur in the winter, their time is compressed. And they're working probably harder. What they do with the rest of their time is no more of the state's concern than what a regular employee does who's taking time off and going to Maui or someplace, you know? The time off that they're not working is their own. But the thing that the state's concerned about is the time that the employee's working for the state. And it seems to me less important when that time occurs than how much time occurs and why it's compressed. And I'm looking now solely at the firefighters, because they seem to me the most deserving in this whole group. And I'd like to maybe look at that and then look at these others.
Through the chair, Representative Bloomberg. Clearly, right now, the firefighters' benefit, if they vest, is the same by treating the overtime at an annualized basis, which we currently do, or recognizing the overtime as longer service spread out through the year. In other words, an employee who as an example, in a six-month period of time, earns $30,000 because of overtime, and if you figure that that's an additional month of service because they would have earned $20,000, or, well, let's say an employee who has 6 months in which they earn $2,000 a month, and then they earn an additional $12,000 because they work the equivalent of four more months of overtime, gets the same benefit now if they're vested as they would treating that as a half a year at 24,000 versus three quarters of a year at an average salary of 16,000. So in essence, the salary annualization treats their benefit amount the same. So they're getting recognition right now in the system. There's no inequity there. And this is why I kind of nodded when you said about the issue of vesting. That's really the issue. That's the only thing that this bill does differently than what our current system already provides for. So that's why I'm saying, if we're concerned about recognizing to allow them to receive a benefit earlier than what would normally be received.
Oh, I see.
Then that's, you know, once you get them through that threshold of being eligible for a benefit, then they're treated fine. And if the concern is that they don't work as much time.
So vesting, is it truly vesting or is it when you receive the benefit? I'm getting educated here. I think I see what you mean.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Groomberg, the reason I don't say vesting is because we have other provisions, as I pointed out, with the legislative employees, where they aren't considered vested. They are considered eligible for a benefit earlier than waiting for the 5 years of credited service, after they serve for 5 legislative sessions. Now, there's a lot of employees that will go on to serve, in essence, the equivalent of 5 credited years, and they then become vested. But the employees who serve for 5 legislative sessions, you know, within a certain amount of time, get eligible for a benefit. And that's not to say that that might not be the preferable way to deal with firefighters if, in fact, that's what the real concern of this bill is.
Thank you. I'm not convinced what you're saying is that it's actually correct, and I'd really like to see it in black and white, that because of the formula that you pay someone, and I'm not as familiar with PERS as I am TERS, but in TERS we get 2% a year and the highest 3-year salary. And I would be interested to see how some of these examples might actually compare. Obviously, somebody's not going to vest anywhere near as soon under the existing system as they would with this amendment. And number two, I'm not sure you're being, that is exactly correct, and I'd like to see that, some examples of how somebody who worked so many years but had, you know, if those weren't counted as full years, they wouldn't get their percentage per year. It's going to be far lower. So I'd really like to see some scenarios on how that works out. I also want to go to talk, and we have several people to testify, and what I would like is for you to stay with us while they do so. Go ahead to respond.
Sure, Mr. Chairman, if I might. I think it's important to point out, and it's already been referred to once, that there's an inequity between the teachers and the public employee systems. The teachers is a different retirement system. The judicial is a different retirement system. They serve different types of employees, different levels of education, different general work schedules. I would say to try to analogize that in the teacher system, you find a situation where teachers work a lot of overtime. Most teachers don't get paid overtime. So it's really not the same type of a thing. But I'll be happy to draw up some scenarios and get that to you in writing.
There's no objections. I'm going to go and take some testimony from the teleconference. Fairbanks, are you online?
Yeah, Fairbanks online.
Go ahead, Fairbanks. Whoever you have up there, state your name and address for the record, please, who you're representing, and please go ahead.
Yeah, my name is Tom Kurth, K-U-R-T-H, post office box 60337, Fairbanks, Alaska. Currently, I'm a Forester 1 with the Department of Natural Resources, Division of Forestry. I started as a firefighter or forest technician in 1979, and I've worked as a Forest Tech 2, 3, Forest Tech 4, and finally Forester 1 through 13 years here now, and technically I have about what amounts to 7 years of service accredited into the retirement it's Representative Boyer or Moyer. I'm twisted around by now.
All right, they get twisted around the hockey games
what
too.
What we're looking for, and yeah. That is a dignified incentive for this retirement system that we work an extreme amount of hours for. That is, if you're a seasonal employee, our seasonal employees start out at what is a 5-month season. Usually with vacancy savings, we cut them right away to 4.5 months. And during that period, they oftentimes work a period of 500 to 800 hours overtime in a fire season. Sometimes it's up to 1,000 hours. That translates into 3 to 5 months of time, and it's time that we do not get credit for in this retirement system. At this point, I'm at a position where I actually hire employees, and we spend a tremendous amount of time doing such a thing. Hiring is a very labor-intensive chore, and when we get a good employee, we like to retain him. And there's nothing like hiring a bad employee to turn your system upside down there. So this represents a way to retain our employees. I'm open for questions if you people have them there. And once again, I appreciate the representative who is articulating our position.
Thank you. That was Representative Boyer with a B. Not to be confused with Moyer with an M, both of Fairbanks. Any questions of the committee? Hearing none. Lauren, are you also up there to testify?
I am. My name is Lauren Rotroff, R-O-T-R-O-F-F. Mailing address is P.O. Box 56763 in North Pole 99705. I'm a forestry technician 3 in the Fairbanks area. And I would like to address my opinion of some of the concerns for people that work in seasonal positions and perhaps shed a little light on their impact on the state and the overall economy. One of my concerns is that an entry-level activity with the Department of Natural Resources as a technician is the way that people are available for permanent positions as they become vacant in the system. And as in the case of Mr. Kurth, who over a period of 13 years has finally gotten himself to a position of a 10-month position as a forester, many people have spent 15 and 18 years in seasonal positions and still not had a vacancy to compete for in the full-time system. And I don't believe that that is a problem, but I think that it needs to be recognized that we are in a recruiting position to try and gather people that are available to give us a resource pool to select for a permanent position. Another problem is turnover, and I think that there is a significant turnover in the number of technicians that work in various fields. And part of that is that they do not have a long-term prospect as far as the benefit of continuing to combine careers, one perhaps a seasonal position with the state, another with some other activity that provides them with income for the rest of their year. From the standpoint of firefighters in particular, the firefighters are required to meet national standards for their position in not only training, education, but physical fitness. Those persons that are seasonal employees working 4.5 months or in some cases less in order to have a position in the system are responsible for being able to employ on an as-needed basis another 1,200 people in the form of village crews, and their income goes directly to the place where we have the least enterprise in the state, and that is the rural villages for the most part. Those people that are seasonal must meet the training, education, and physical standards of a national standard, not of a local standard. This is not an Alaska standard or a Fairbanks standard, but a national standard. It takes about 3 years for a person to accumulate the experience and training necessary to be a crew representative
Tim Boyer.
So you would disagree with Mr. Stalnecker's assessment that this bill isn't necessary as a retention or recruitment and retention tool? Is that what I heard you say, that it is in fact a tool that might be utilized certainly as a retention vehicle, but probably as a recruitment tool as well?
Yes, I do agree that it is an important recruitment and retention tool as pertaining to seasonal employees who elect to use the fire aspect or any other aspect of state jobs to create year-round income for them, and perhaps the anchor point for their career.
Any other comments from the committee? Hearing none, let's go to Soldotna. Thank you, sir, for your comments. Soldotna, Tom Morak.
Yeah, this is Tom Morak.
Morak, thank you, Mr. Morak.
Box 707, Soldotna. And I work out of Soldotna, Kinakoyak Area Office here, Division of Forestry. And just a few comments here to go along with the other folks in Fairbanks and Representative Boyer. Well, I guess we agree that there will always be wildland fires in Alaska and therefore a need for wildland firefighters. It's already been tried and we have not been recognized legislatively approached as firefighters for the 20 year and out. And it's also been recognized by some of your committee members there this morning that we do have spent a lot of time fighting fires, very hazardous conditions, a lot of toxic smoke given off by the various vegetation in Alaska, spending weeks at a time on the fire line. That's very fatiguing, a lot of injury possibilities. It's agreed that the average seasonal position is only 4 or 5 months at best, oftentimes less, as Mr. Kurth mentioned. And the ones that do stick it out each year do become a valuable asset to the state through their knowledge of how the administrative process works, working as oftentimes middle managers, knowing the system economically, making the best decisions, keeping the fire suppression costs down, saves a lot of money for the state. We have a lot of our employees, as Mr. Rotroff mentioned, some of them are getting vested at 12 and 13 years after they've been into the system. We've been fortunate that a lot of these people have stuck around because these people are managing budgets of their own in some cases, working directly for those who do manage a budget. And the difference between a veteran firefighter and a green firefighter, or someone who's got only 3 or 4 seasons under their belts, can translate into several $1 million by 1 or 2 mistakes or poor judgment during an ongoing initial attack fire situation. And I believe that the retirement years, a lot of people have, there has been a large turnover because they see that it's going to take them forever in their own minds to become vested in the system. They move on to the field. And I think that it would behoove us to recognize seasonal firefighters as a specialty group and to support this need for the vesting opportunity here. That'd be all I have to say at this point.
Thank you, sir. I did forget to note, I apologize, Representative Bruckman has been with us for almost the entire meeting, and I never mentioned her name. Is there anyone else in Soldotna? Mark?
Yes, I'd just like to say a few things.
Go ahead, please, your full name and address.
My name is Mark Moldenhauer, Post Office Box 595, Stern, Alaska. I'm a seasonal forestry technician also, and I am for this bill. I agree with those that have spoken on behalf of seasonals, including Mark Boyer. I just
Who's next, please? Diane?
She's had to leave, but the next participant's ready to testify.
Go ahead.
Yes, this is, my name is Don Valesco, and I'm the business manager of Public Employees Local 71, offices are at 2510 Arctic Boulevard here in Ames. Also have offices in Juneau and Fairbanks. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I'd like to just shed a little bit of light on the situation. There's several positions throughout the state, or several classifications in different departments that where they have seasonal employees that work just part of the year, and in a lot of these cases they work tremendous hours of overtime. You've heard from some foresters, there's fish and game techs, you have highway engineering techs and engineering techs also, and engineering assistants. I'm just going to name a few seasonal equipment operators, and there's a few in the Department of Labor, Employment Division, and anyway, it's not just limited to forestry and those people there. I think back a number of years to one of my members who have to work out of Fairbanks, highway engineering technician. I won't mention any names, but she had worked for the Department of Transportation, started a little later in life, raised her family, and then went out on her own after her husband, Lee, had passed away. She was in her 60s after having worked 13 years with the Department of Transportation, seasonally in the summers on highway construction projects, along with all the other trades that are out there in the construction and private sector industry, and had not vested in the system. 13 years working 2, 3, 4, in some cases 5 to 6 months a year. She came down with an illness. She was still somewhere near six months shy of vesting in the system. Fortunately, she had a number of compassionate fellow employees, and they were able to arrange through their unions to donate their annual leave to her, and she did get her last 6 months in order to vest. Unfortunately, she passed away within a short time after that, but she did have medical coverage and was able to receive some kind of stipend from the state for those 5 years of service. These employees in these various positions, and I think of the highway engineering techs that are working out there right alongside of people, equipment operators, laborers, and others in the construction industry, where they come under ERISA, and after they reach a threshold of 1,000 hours, they get a credit for full year service. That's not what this bill is asking. It's asking only that if they work a full year or a normal full year for the state, or some portion of it less than that, that they get credit on a prorated basis. You take a look at, and may or may not be on track, but I think the legislators, their staff, get credit for each year of service. I understand the hours, the tremendous hours that they put in during those 4 months that they're in session, and some of them do work in the off session, but those that are there, put their 4 months in and don't have much more work during the rest of the year, will get credit for a full year of service. If you have them under the same system as the rest of the seasonal employees with the state, you would be looking at 15 years for legislature to vest or in staff person to vest. There is an inequity as you look at it from that point. You know, taking it from credit from day one of the session till it ends, although I understand the type of work you folks do, and I don't need to. They do work during the out of the session, after the session, with a lot of constituent calls, because I call you a ton.
What provision do they have?
The fact is, a lot of the aides and the staffers there that
five
work only for 4 months don't get credit for a full year. They have to come into the system as these other employees.
The system.
It would take them 3 years to get 1 year's credit. Let me address the overtime and the higher benefits. Some of the highway engineering techs that are members of Public Employees Local 71, which I represent, do work tremendous hours during the summer. But what good does it do them if they work and get paid overtime?
Thank you, Don. I don't have anyone else scheduled to testify, or Mr. Boyer, or the department. Do you want to make any comments on the testimony?
Mr. Chairman, I would just add that certainly I did not mean to infer that enhancing the benefits or improving the benefits wouldn't help to further retain or further attract employees. My point was that the employer at this point does not seem to be having difficulty attracting and retaining, so the purpose of enhancing would not be seen as necessary in the employers. But anytime you increase benefits, you're going to make them more attractive.
Can we have a fiscal note from you by tomorrow?
Mr. Chairman, you should have one. I'm surprised that you don't, but this one has already gone upstairs. We do not anticipate there being, now perhaps based on the new hours that I've received by testimony of different people, if we're talking 500 to 800 average hours of overtime per seasonal employee, then perhaps that will impact the fiscal note. But from the information we've gotten for most employees, we do not anticipate there to be a measurable impact for an increase in the number of people that would become vested. Since the salary portion and the benefit amount is already treated that way, equitably, there's no additional cost there. So it would just be an analysis of how many additional people we would anticipate would become vested. Now, I'll check the numbers and see if we were basing this on 100 hours of overtime a year on average, rather than 500 to 800 hours of overtime, then perhaps we may need to revisit our numbers. But at this point in time, we're not anticipating there to be a measurable impact.
Okay. Any other comments from the committee? Representative Moyer.
Yes, thanks, Mr. Chairman. I wanted to follow up on the fiscal office. First, as I've listened to the testimony, I just want to say that I think the state of Alaska has been, always will be, is the architect of social policy. Whether it's devising retirement programs or whatever. And maybe the private sector doesn't have this role. We heard testimony or comments about how they differ, and perhaps indeed they do differ. There's plenty of examples of workers in the private sector who weren't able to vest at the end of whether it's a four-year iron worker's career of Jim Boyer or someone like him. So I think it's entirely appropriate we consider this. But I wanted to ask a question on the fiscal notes now that you brought it up, though. I have inquired to the third floor. I assume that's what you're going to be said upstairs. Fiscal note has gone upstairs.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Boyer, upstairs meaning to our commissioners.
Well, nonetheless, I understand there's some process that fiscal note's having to go through the governor's office before you come to the legislature. I wonder if you could describe how you think it works or supposed to work.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Boyer, I don't know. All I know is we'll prepare a fiscal note and send it up to the commissioner's office for review and then forwarding through whatever channels are required.
Any other comments by the committee? Entertain a motion? Representative Bruckman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move that we pass the committee with recommendation.
There's a motion to move the bill with individual recommendations. Are there objections? Hearing no objections, the bill is moved with individual recommendations. Next bill on the calendar is HGR 51 relating to the halting of nuclear weapons, the testing of nuclear weapons. H.D.R. 51 is a resolution urging the United States to join with the other countries in the world to suspend nuclear testing for all time and to implement a comprehensive test ban treaty. The prime sponsors here represent Nilo, Kopanen.
Thank you. I'm Nilo Kopanen, representative of Commission 21. And the world has changed considerably since we put this resolution in. The Soviet Union has come unglued, and it's no longer possible to get a comprehensive treaty with a central power that no longer exists. It's fallen apart into a Commonwealth of Independent States, which is at least momentarily their name, and they possess all the nuclear weapons that belong to the former Soviet Union, but they're scattered in Kazakhstan, Ukraine, and Russia, the Russian Federation, principally. One of the problems is that there are other powers, such as Iraq and Iran, and possibly Israel and South Africa, and who knows what all. I remember that Peron was trying to build a bomb when he was in charge of Argentina, and at that time the theory was he was trying to make it out of polonium. But nowadays, with scientific experts in the Soviet Union unemployed, lack of control by the central government, we need to have, more than ever, a comprehensive treaty that does set some international control. And actually, there doesn't seem to be any point in continuing to build bombs in order to explode them underground to see if they go bang. I think we have quite enough. I think as many as 10 years ago, it was pointed out we had enough nuclear weapons aimed at the then Soviet Union to destroy it 62 times over, mostly to see the rubble bounce. And so that we were in a great danger of proliferation, uncontrolled proliferation at this point. So we've tried to amend the resolution, and therefore we have this joint resolution committee substitute.
Is this committee substitute the same as the Senate passed, or is it still different than that one? The Senate passed when the Senate State Affairs did.
You mean the last session? No, this is different. This takes into account the changes since the last session.
Mr. Chairman,
I don't. No longer.
You don't have a CS in your package? Questions, Representative Kopanen? Representative Greenberg?
Are we on telephone? Yes. Just on the CS, we have a couple of typos. On line 13, encourages should be encouraged.
Ah.
And on line 14, hampers should be hampered. And I'd ask that the staff make those corrections. Also, I just have one concern, Mr. Chairman, with lines 15 and 16 of the CS. And I do think that these are weapons. They're certainly weapons of deterrence. And I am concerned about that particular whereas. That's my main concern. But I would feel more comfortable with that particular one if I was doing.
Comment on that, Representative Kopanen. It is a pretty strong statement, and obviously a statement that where some people may agree with your desire to stop the testing, they may not certainly agree with that statement.
Well, we haven't had for a decade or more any release of information that indicated that they've learned anything new about the bombs themselves. find different kinds of warheads and certainly controls and directions that they learn this and what like that, but that's not part of it. And it becomes rather difficult, I think, for the United States to call for restriction of nuclear weapons if we continue to test fire. I'm not sure that we haven't got that information released, but sometimes it seems like that's one way of disposing of surplus weapons. Somebody could show me what purpose it serves. I could probably, you know, I might, but I cannot see anything, either location of the bombs or anyway, but we seem to have found out what we need to know in locating the source of explosion, both seismically and from space. And I guess it is my firm belief that, you know, if we continue testing new nuclear weapons, that other countries will treat this as another case of American do as I say, not as I do.
That's a note. Maybe one thing we should do is, why don't we adopt this CS for discussion purposes, so we have the right bill before us. I'd entertain a motion to do so. Representative Grunberg.
I move we adopt the Bannister 121 CS.
As corrected.
As corrected with those two typos.
CS is before us. Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I, too, do have a proposal, though, about line 15 and 16 on the first page. That whereas, and I do believe that nuclear weapons over the years have been used as a deterrent, and they are not necessarily instruments of terrorism. And I do have concerns with that particular whereas too, so at this time I will make a motion to strike that particular whereas.
Okay, there is a motion to strike lines 15 and 16, that whereas. Is there objection? Is there objection? Hearing no objections, lines 15 and 16 are deleted. Representative Breckman?
Thank you. I think they are weapons, and they also are instruments of destruction, so I'm somewhat confused by the argument.
I believe the real concern is the words terrorism and genocide.
I think they're the ultimate weapon, you know, but I'm not objecting to the deletion, but I just want to make a statement that I differ.
We are on teleconference also. I have some people to testify. Is there other comments from the committee?
I don't think there was any objection.
No. Hearing no objections, that motion is objected. Nilo, why don't you just slide around there a little bit and stick with this. Jamie, did you want to certainly comment on this?
May I speak briefly to something you've already accomplished? My name is James E. Fisher. My address is 633 Harris Street, Juneau, Alaska. I have been a resident of Alaska for decades and decades. I was actually in the first state legislature when the legislature began voting on these things, and Bob Bartlett came down and straightened us out. Bob Bartlett, as you recall, was one of the first senators of the state of Alaska, and he told us how dangerous it was and told us not to get involved in anything involved like the proposed test that occurred up, or was proposed to occur up at Point Hope. And I've always remembered that very fondly, because he really set our heads straight as to the dangers that could occur with, then we were talking atomic blast, we weren't talking nuclear. Specifically to the item that you were just recently talking about, I think you should keep it in. I think you should reinstate it. And the reasons for keeping it in and reinstating it is that you cannot use a nuclear weapon that won't come back on you. It will blow back on you. It will come to haunt you. And if you don't believe that, all you have to do is ask or relate to something that was not even a nuclear exchange, and that was Chernobyl. The Chernobyl was just a terrible disaster in the immediate vicinity and almost throughout the world. There were effects, even though it was not intended and was substantially minimized. You cannot use a nuclear weapon without coming back to literally haunt you or kill you. And for that reason, I think such a statement should be included. However, let's move on to what may or may not be practical. I've been testifying on these resolutions for a number of years, and it's extremely important that we do something about the terrible mess that we put ourselves in with respect to nuclear manufacturing, nuclear testing, nuclear arming. It has been estimated that the cost of cleanup in our sloppy operations will cost this country $150 billion. That isn't in Russia. That is right in the United States. That's at Rocky Flats. That's down in our neighboring state of Washington. It's in Georgia. It's in Ohio. It's all over the United States. I think it's exceedingly important that nuclear testing be suspended and that we get on with the cleanup. I think it's entirely possible that the President of the United States might actually make such a declaration in the very near future. It's even possible that he's supposed to be hinting at it in the State of the Union speech. I think for those reasons that this committee substitute for House Joint Resolution number 51 should be adopted, and I would urge that it be adopted as presented in its originally proposed form. I'd be glad to answer any questions, try to respond from the viewpoint of an informed layperson.
Mr. Fisher, and also Representative Copeland, one other thing does concern me about this, and that is, I think it's unlikely at the present time that Russia is, in its disorganized state particularly, is going to do anything other than be going to go along with what we're talking about, and I applaud that. The people I'm concerned about are people like Saddam Hussein, who have this capability, refuse to allow any inspection, refuse to honor their agreements, and I read this bill over the weekend and again this morning, and I'm concerned a little bit that maybe it should be even stronger to deal with these nuts.
I'm not sure that I'm responding precisely on point to you, Representative Grunberg, but I would say that it probably ought to be stronger, and I think the phrase that has been proposed for deletion would make it stronger. So therefore, I would propose that you leave that lines 15 and 16 in the proposed draft. I would go one step further and say that the suspension of testing on a worldwide basis would then make testing anywhere much more readily discoverable, and therefore would hopefully enhance the safety of the world, of which we are a substantial part.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Fisher. Appreciate
Thank you, sir.
Going to Anchorage on the teleconference, Christopher Toll.
Yes, I'm here. Do you hear me?
Go ahead, Mr. Toll.
I'm the director of a statewide peace and justice organization with 1,100 members named Sane Alaska, and we've been involved in these issues for about 9 years now. Our group was the sponsor of a ballot measure which passed statewide by the voters in 1986, which established the official policy of the state regarding nuclear weapons, and that is to support a mutual
Mr. Toll?
Measure at our disposal to bring them around. And these will include on-site inspections and close monitoring of the transfer of nuclear technology. After all, Saddam Hussein was able to build his nuclear complex with the help of U.S. technology, which was shuttled through South Africa, with the help of German and French technology. And if we get the cooperation of our allies in this, we can virtually shut off the development of nuclear technology, which is needed to produce nuclear weapons. This isn't simple equipment.
Mr. Toll, may I break in, please?
Machinery and equipment
is he here
to be able to produce nuclear weapons. Only with cooperation of the international community and enhancement of the non-proliferation regime that we're going to have any success in this area.
Why don't you call up the moderator?
And finally, as has been brought out before, our chief adversary is gone. The Soviet Union has collapsed. And like I said, Boris Yeltsin has pledged to halt testing. They aren't testing now. They haven't tested in some time. Their main testing site in Kazakhstan has been shut down. There's one remaining test site that the Russian Republic could possibly use, but isn't likely to, and that's in the Arctic. They can only test there 2-3 months out of the year, even if they wanted to. But as I said before, the American people are for this. Polling data has consistently showed that approximately 80% of the American people are in favor of a halt of nuclear testing. And as I mentioned before, here in Alaska, our official state policy is to have a mutually verifiable freeze of which nuclear testing is part of. So, just in conclusion, it's the probably most powerful argument for it is that people want it. Every district in the state passed this freeze policy without exception. And I think that it's time to take advantage of this golden opportunity we have to enhance our own security and make a better world. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Toll. What's the pleasure of the committee?
Mr. Chairman,
Before
we do move out of committee, I brought this, I'm going to bring it up on all these, and there was one other last year I brought it up. On page 2, lines 19, there's a couple of U.S. congressional bills which are being considered. And then farther down the road there, on line 27, we ask our congressional delegation to support those. I do not find them in the packet, and I certainly would like to see what they read before I ask our congressional delegation to support those.
Certainly a valid concern. Representative Kopman? What line number was that? I just read
19, and then
right.
Farther down on 27, where we asked our delegation to support that.
What are those bills? Nilo, do you know what they are?
But Mr. Chairman, just to clarify that whether it's this resolution or any other, I think it would just be fair to members of the legislature that those items would be provided in any packet that we're doing something like this, because we shouldn't be knowing what we're asking our congressional delegation to do.
Point well taken.
Essentially, the Senate bill is Nuclear Testing Moratorium Act. Senate Bill 2064, co-sponsored by Senator Mark Hatfield, Republican of Oregon, and Senate Majority Leader George Mitchell, which would cut funding for nuclear weapons tests for 12 months or as long as the Soviet Union or its successor states did not test. The Senate bill currently has 10 co-sponsors. The Hatfield-Mitchell bill is almost identical to the Gephardt-Kopetsky bill, which is House Bill 3636, which has 173 co-sponsors, and they're currently in live consideration. I think the Senate bill having a bipartisan co-sponsorship might have the better chance.
With that request, Representative Miller, I think maybe the best thing to do is hold this bill till Wednesday. We'll take it up first thing on Wednesday after members of the committee have the ability to go ahead and review those two bills. Does anybody disagree with that in the committee? Probably the fair thing to do.
Ms. Hamburger.
I'm going to come back to what I was saying earlier. I think that the issue is, at this point, not mainly testing, but mainly enforcement of existing bans against these people like Saddam Hussein. And the bill itself, as drafted, is limited solely to testing. And I think that the focus at this point in the world is somewhat away from the testing and on these other issues, with that particular thing being an example. And I'm wondering how the sponsor would feel about including that sort of thing in this bill, because we don't get into this very often.
Actually, I would agree. We'd have to change the title on the bill, and I didn't feel that it was proper to offer a title change to the committee without the committee's prior concurrence on that here, so I can discuss that with you.
Mr. Chairman, with the idea that this thing is going to be back before the committee on Wednesday, I would conceptually offer to the committee the suggestion that we broaden the title to include that sort of thing and include some language in it.
I would maybe suggest that the issues within the whole nuclear weapons program are broad, and I think that they're very maybe a real easy consensus on banning of testing of nuclear weapons, but the debate that you get into on other things will, you know, maybe make this bill harder or more debatable on the floor. I don't know, but maybe rather than doing that, maybe we should introduce a separate resolution in dealing with the separate issues in nuclear weapons.
I frankly think that there'd be very little debate when you're talking about making certain that we can enforce the bans against people like Saddam Hussein. I would think that that would be less controversial. And with just the addition of some small amount of language, would do it. I mean, it's up to the sponsor, I think, and yourself, Mr. Chairman.
Well, what's the point, Max? Are they not doing that as best they can? I mean, the whole United States government has been putting effort on doing exactly that for months. We have nuclear inspectors over there. I mean, are we doing something what's the point? Everybody in the world would say, yeah, it wants Saddam Hussein to have nuclear weapons. What are we trying to prove here?
If we're expressing the sense of the state legislature, that seems to me to make some sense to express that, but it's up to the committee.
Tim Wynn.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to take up for a moment Jamie's remarks and not objecting to the removal of that, whereas I have to admit I had a hard time swallowing the fact that nuclear weapons are not weapons. In fact, if you look it up in the dictionary, weapons are an offensive or defensive combat instrument. Perhaps within that, whereas there are some facts that we may have deleted that we don't need to. I think at least the experts say that you can't use them safely. They certainly can be an instrument of terrorism and genocide, and maybe there's a way for us to rework that to leave the facts in that doesn't include what made us uncomfortable or calling a weapon not a weapon. I'll work on that between now and then.
The comments?
Senate hearing for SJR 22 had testimony from Rear Admiral Eugene Carroll, speaking on behalf of himself, said he was basing his testimony on background 30 years of experience in nuclear weapons planning, training, and operation. His last major operations were in Europe, where he's responsible for the security, readiness, command, and control of 7,000 nuclear weapons. Based on his experience, he said, nuclear weapons have no military utility or logistical purposes. You can never defend anything. The only thing you can do with nuclear weapons is destroy or just be destroyed. He related that the United States has 20,000 of them now, and he says that's far too many for deterrence purposes. If you will remember, they withdrew battlefield nuclear weapons, the Long Tom and other things, precisely because the cannon that fired the nuclear shell would also be destroyed by the nuclear explosion, and the nuclear depth charges, which are out in the ADAC, have been rendered unoperational because of the same purpose. The ship dropping the nuclear depth charge would also be caught in the fallout and the underwater blast pose. So it would seem that there are 20,000 nuclear weapons are more than enough to something like three times as many as necessary to destroy all life on Earth. It seems to be. take the guns and I'll shoot that guy if you don't do it, I say. So I think I would be willing to work with Representative.